Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of It's Easy, Son, your life lessons on your journey to your purpose. With me today, I have a former co-worker and colleague from Johnson C. Smith University, Go Bulls, and a gentleman who has spent much of his life in the service of others. He has been one that's a staunch advocate, not only in his community, but in his role when he was at Johnson C. Smith with myself, from the State House to the local city council. He has just been one that stands up for those who can't at times speak for themselves. Ladies and gentlemen, joining me today is my good friend and former colleague at Johnson C. Smith, Mr. Malcolm Graham. Mr. Graham, good afternoon. How are you, sir?
Good afternoon, Gerald. It's an honor and a pleasure to be with you this afternoon.
Well, the feeling is mutual, my friend. And as I said in the brief intro there, you know, a lot of people will see you and very humble individual that you are, but they don't know the length and breadth of the state of North Carolina and the passion that you have for people. So I'm just so humbled that you joined little old me today. So prior to our call, I kind of shared with you how this podcast goes. We go for anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour, depending on how the conversation flows. But I don't speak a lot. I just ask a lot of open-ended questions, and it turns into a conversation. But what we want to do is to learn about Malcolm Graham and his early years coming up, what grounds him, his family, and his structures around him that has guided him to where he is today. And won't give away much, but organically have you share with the group, the audience, so to speak, what your background and journey is. So if that's okay, we could just jump right in. You know, tell us a little bit about Malcolm Graham. Who is Malcolm Graham and what drives him?
Thank you, Gerald, for the opportunity to communicate with you today. Malcolm is just Malcolm, right? I was born in January 14, 1963 in Charleston, South Carolina. I was the sixth kid from Henrietta and Melvin Graham. My mother was a domestic worker. My father, a truck driver in Charleston. If we were poor, I didn't know it. They instilled in us hard values, that we were just as good as anyone else, and don't believe what we were seeing around us. Charleston, as you know, has a unique history. Like I said, my mom worked for a Jewish family. She cleaned houses, but she was a woman of faith. My father was a man of faith. And every Sunday morning, we would wake up and I would smell corned beef hash, grits, bacon, and eggs. And we were on our way to Emmanuel AME Church. That was our Sunday ritual. That was how we concluded our week and began a new week. And so that's who I am. I'm Henrietta and Melvin's youngest child.
Wow. So you speak so fondly, and your parents have come up. Talk to us a little bit about the values they instilled in you and your siblings and those that were around you.
My mom didn't play. it's just that simple. She was a strict disciplinarian in terms of teaching us right, wrong. It was only one way, was her way. And fortunate for us that her way was always the right way. Mm-hmm. Love your family, work in the community, go to church on Sunday, bring A's and B's home, yes sir, no ma'am, being respectful. We dressed up, we clean clothes. An upbringing that I stand on today. It's the foundation of what I stand on today. This great lady, great father, demonstrating that when you look in the mirror and you saw what you saw, that you were much bigger and better than what you saw. And she encouraged us to reach for the stars, encouraged me to do things out of the box. You know, I played tennis in Charleston, and growing up in the 70s, late 70s, as a black tennis player, that was not very common. And I would get teased by some of my friends and call me names. And she said, no, if this is what you want to do and you're good at it, continue to do it. She encouraged schoolwork. She encouraged thinking out of the box. She took me to community meetings. I was very active in the church, and Emmanuel, again, was one of our stomping grounds, and all these political figures and people would come through the church in terms of social justice and civil rights. And as a young kid, I would just be in the back of the church waiting for her to get done, just absorbing it all in. And it obviously shaped who I am today. Again, just such a beautiful upbringing in Charleston, and just all the type of role models, both in terms of my parents in the home, but even the players at the tennis courts. I mean, there were black doctors and principals and teachers. And so not only did I get an education at home, but I got an education at the tennis courts beyond the game of tennis. And that was the time, Gerald, when everybody was your parent, right? That you got parent at home, you got parent in school, you got parent in social settings at the tennis court. Because the phrase that we say today, it takes a village to teach a child, that's a saying today. When I was growing up, that was a reality. Mm-hmm. Everyone took a turn in terms of putting furniture polish on me and Windex. Everybody kind of buffed me up. Everyone kept me in line. Everyone made sure I had the tools necessary to succeed.
Wow, that is so true. That is so true. But tennis, did you started playing tennis when you were rather young. What was grade school and high school like? Did you start tennis like from early out?
Yeah, I started playing tennis probably about 10, 11 years old. I was infatuated with Arthur Ashe. He was my first young role model, right? He was an African-American man doing something that was uniquely different, playing this white sport. He had a social consciousness about him where he would not go play tennis in South Africa because of apartheid. He was good, right? And he held his head high. He had an afro. Is what I wanted to be. And so I started playing tennis early, played tennis through high school. We had a really, really good tennis team. That's when this whole explosion of tennis and black players beginning to play the game. And I was a part of that era. And a good friend of mine, Andre Rambert, and Glenn Bass, and Kevin Hicks, and we all were really good, and we all got college scholarships to play tennis. So I played throughout my high school. I wrestled a little bit in high school and played a little bit of basketball, but I always came back to the game of tennis because I just loved the sport, loved sweating, loved, you know, Arthur Ashe being that role model for me, and I wanted to kind of be like him. And so my high school days were, you know, really simple. Tennis, studying, following my mom's rules and making sure I stayed out of her way in terms of not getting in trouble, right? Because she, like I said, she was the taskmaster.
Yeah. So let me ask you a question. I asked this of all of the former athletes that are on this show. You know, there is this thin line, and you hear this expression today, student athlete. And there seems to be now a clear line of demarcation between student and athlete. But as you were just talking, in your mind, your parents' background in terms of their disciplinarian and being disciplinarian, and also your sports, and then you talked about bringing home A's and B's, are all of those things linked and have set the foundation on which you currently stand today and what propelled you forward?
Yeah, they're all linked, right? Because If I was not doing well in school, there was no way that I was going to the tennis courts in the afternoon, right? And
Right.
so I knew when I woke up in the morning that I had to excel in the classroom because that was my key to get out of the house, right? And so getting A's and B's and that was the standard, right? C's was like, no, A and B, and even a B may get you a side look from my mom, right? And so the standards were set high, and I knew that was the gateway for me being on the going to the tennis court. And so it was all about overachieving. And then when I went to the tennis courts in the afternoon, I wanted to overachieve because I wanted to be good, right? I just didn't want to be out there just, you know, out there. I wanted to be very competitive. I wanted to be, at that time, a professional tennis player, right? And you know, and so I wanted to excel. I worked hard at it. And so hard work was always a part of the fabric of my family, right? My mom worked hard. My father worked hard. My brothers and sisters were role models. They all worked hard. And so, I mean, hard work was what I was raised upon, you know, in school, out of school, and just doing those things necessary to achieve the results that I needed. And so, you know, I worked hard, and I didn't know anything other than do. And I know that the linkage between me being a varsity tennis player or going to a social party in high school or asking my mom for an allowance all came back to, okay, what did you do in the classroom? Because,
wow.
I mean, she didn't care about my tennis playing or that I was a good tennis player. She only wanted to see the report card every 6 weeks, right?
That says it all, I guess, right?
Yeah, that was the standard.
So yeah. Let's switch gears a little bit. Now, I met you at Johnson C. Smith, the Golden Blue. You wrestled in high school. You played. I didn't know about the wrestling, so it now makes sense because you're a big dude, you know. So you get to Johnson C. Smith on a tennis scholarship. Talk to us a little bit about Johnson C. Smith. I know what this place means to you and so many other people. But being at that HBCU and that moment in time, what did Johnson C. Smith mean to you? Johnson C. Smith mean to you then, and what does it mean to you now?
I was first introduced to Johnson C. Smith University by my homeroom teacher, Dolores Lee, who was a graduate of Johnson C. Smith University. Dr. Lee lives in Charlotte. I know her very well. She was my sophomore high school homeroom teacher. She was 1 year removed from graduating from Smith, and she came in that classroom, and she had total command and control of me in that classroom. And while I was a good student, Gerald, no one really motivated me like she did. I mean, she was just a motivating factor for me. And challenged me in a way that no other teacher to that point had did before. And I just loved everything about Dr. Lee. And being a Smith, I went to a high school recruitment fair. And you know this lady, Jody Turner.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Turner.
Oh, wow.
Came to Charleston, and she was there at a college recruitment fair representing Johnson C. Smith University. And I took the application, and I was, again, very interested in it. I called the tennis coach, my athletic director did, and told them about me. And Smith was playing in a tournament in Durham, North Carolina. And the tennis coach invited me to come up to Durham, playing the tournament so he can see me play. And Dr. Lee, of course, was encouraging that. Joni Turner already had my application all sealed. Went up there, I played in the tournament, and played well, didn't win it, but played well enough for the school to offer me a scholarship. And the following January, they invited me to tour the campus, and it was a Saturday night, Gerald, and they were playing Livingstone College, and they probably had about 5,000 people in that gym, Gerald.
Wow.
And I was thrown. I mean, the band was playing.
Mm-hmm.
That's when the team was real good, when they had Flores and Blue Oliver and Bill Tibbs, and I mean, people all over the place. I'm going to age myself. I ran to the payphone and I told my mom, I'm coming to Smith. And my mom was a little disappointed, actually, because I got a scholarship offer to go to the Citadel, which is a military school in Charleston, which was very prestigious. But my mom was tougher than any military sergeant, so I didn't need 4 years of that.
Right.
But the environment of Smith, the people, the gym, the cheerleaders, the tennis team, Dr. Law I met on that trip. I mean, all those folks, Jody Turner, Dr. Lee, all those folks really encouraged me to come to Smith. I spent 4 years there, met my wife there, my best friends, my campaign manager, people I rely upon, all are Smithites. And that probably was the best decision I've ever made in terms of coming to Charlotte and Johnson C. Smith. Harvey Gantt, again, born and raised in Charleston, was here in Charlotte just getting ready to run for mayor. And so I had all these people that I knew that were really encouraging me and role models. And I was right here in the city.
So Brave Boy Madness did it for you?
It did it for me, Joe. It was, it was unbelievable.
Yeah.
I've never seen, that was the time, Gerald, when the band was able to play during the course of play. And so the team was playing up and down the court, playing, and the band was still playing.
Wow.
And that was legal back then. It was a madhouse.
Yeah, Brave Boy Madness. If folks haven't experienced Brave Boy Madness, they haven't really experienced it. So you get to Smith. I'm sure you had a wonderful time there. But all of my guests that are HBCU graduates, I keep asking for a finer point. What did that experience do for you? And how did that launch you into what's next?
Well, the school was small enough where it gave me an opportunity to be a leader, right? So I was involved in freshman class activities. I was involved on the tennis team. I got involved in student government. I got involved where I knew my professors by name. They saw me on the yard. It was such a small community, a loving community, caring community. And again, everyone really cared about who I was as a student, and they cared about my success. And it came to a point where, you know, everyone at that time, and still, you know, we had choices. I could have went to the Citadel, but I came to Smith. My wife had a scholarship to go to Chapel Hill. She came to Smith. Dr. Octavia Cannon, you know Dr. Cannon.
Dr. Cannon.
She could have went to Michigan. She could have went to Michigan State. She came to Smith, and it was something about being a Smithite, being in that environment, that nurturing, caring, challenging environment. And I had the same situation. I had a pledge my sophomore year, and my grades took a dive because of it. I mean, you would have thought Dr. Law was my father. He was like, "What are you doing? I don't care about you being a Kappa. I care about you trying to go to law school, and this semester just won't do that for you."
Right? Wow. He was that blunt, huh?
Yeah. And so it was that type of environment. And so the takeaway for me of being a Smithite is it had meaning. Being a Smithite had meaning then. And it meant that you were prepared. It meant that you were sharp. It meant that you were candid. It meant that you were given leadership opportunities to excel. It meant that you were ready 4 years after you entered.
Mm. So Smith has a way of growing on people. I'm not a Smithite. I'm a Bison. But I spent almost a decade there as an administrator, and I saw the impact it had on so many young people. But as you left Smith, now when it kind of dovetail a little bit, public service is what you're known for. Now that you mentioned growing up, Emmanuel AME, and sitting in the back and waiting for your mom to be done and soaking up all of the civil rights leaders coming through there. But I'm pretty sure that when you got to Smith, that was either enhanced or accelerated. But where did this love for helping the least of these or being a public servant, when did that start? At Smith, before Smith, or how did that come into being?
It started before Smith, and Smith enhanced it, right? And so my mom used to volunteer for a gentleman by the name of Jim Clyburn. Jim Clyburn
just
now
a gentleman,
the,
huh?
No, he's the third highest Democrat in the U.S. Congress, and he was running for Secretary of State. And so I met him at an early age. I remember watching the Watergate hearings on TV. I remember people talking about Harvey Gantt. I mean, Harvey Gantt used to come to the tennis court, and people used to make a big deal about him back then. And I'm like, why are y'all making a big deal about this guy? He can't play tennis well. And then, of course, I got slapped side of the head. Like, no, we're not talking about his tennis. We're talking about the doors he opened for people like you by attending Clemson University, being the first African-American. He graduated from Burke High School as valedictorian. This guy is more than just a tennis player. This guy is a civil rights leader. And so I got an education then. And then when I came to Smith, I majored in political science. Dr. Dent and Dr. Hermit, refined that interest and showed me different avenues to go to law school or public service, et cetera. I participated in student government, so I ran for office on campus and won. And so, again, it was inherited from watching my mom, watching people around me, getting a formal education at Smith, having the opportunity to say, I want to run for sophomore class president and winning, and then learning how to lead. And so all of that, again, was just something that, you know, from an early age, I just wanted to help people help themselves.
Well, that you did. So after Smith, what was your next move after Smith? Because we all knew you made it to the North Carolina Senate, and there was a process you had to go through. And how did you navigate those waters as you made your way up?
I got lucky, Gerald, right? And so my first job, Olive Smith, was working for Lupin Family Service, which is a child care group home. And I stayed there for a year. And then I got a job as the assistant executive director for the Carolinas Minority Supplier Development Council. It's a nonprofit organization. And what we did was help minority business owners identify major corporations to do business with. It was headquartered in Charlotte, but it had affiliate chapters in six cities throughout the Carolinas: Charleston, Columbia, Greenville, South Carolina, Charlotte, Greensboro, Raleigh, and Fayetteville. I got the job as the assistant executive director. 6 months into it, the board fired the executive director and made me interim executive director. I was like 23 years old.
Wow.
And then gave me the permanent job, saying, well, you can't do any worse than he did. and so at 24, I was the executive director of this nonprofit organization, two states, affiliated with the national chapter. So there's 44 other chapters like this throughout the country that reported up to a national organization. I was 24 years old. And individuals like Floyd Young and Harvey Gantt and other business owners, Sam Johnson, who owned the African-American car dealership back then, that probably had to be about 87. All those guys really took me under their wings. Hugh McCall, Bill Lee, because again, it's a minority organization, corporate organization, doing business with minority business owners. So I got an opportunity to meet all these corporate giants at 24, work with them to help them identify minority firms to do business with. I got an opportunity to work with all these minority business owners. That's how I really got to know Floyd Young and Keith Haywood and all those guys, because we used to meet at Mr. Young's facility here in Charlotte. And so it opened up the door to corporate Charlotte for me. People kind of knew who I was based on that affiliation with the organization. And I stayed there 10 years, and we were able to grow the organization. We won two National Chapters of the Year award. Again, it's a national organization at 44 other chapters throughout the country. I mean, so I was able to make a name for myself by, you know, leading this organization as a very young guy. That at 24 to when I left at 34, and I left because Mr. McCall stole me away. He invited me to come over to Bank of America, made me a vice president for minority business development, and that's when the bank was doing all their building uptown, the Gateway Village Center, the IJL building, the 525 building. My job was to help identify minority contractors. And so, again, yet another high-profile job, giving interaction through all these corporate leaders. And then I walked into Mr. McCall's office one day and said I wanted to run for city council. And he said, sure. And I ran and got my butt whipped. I mean, my first time I ran, I lost. Because I was perceived as being the uptown guy, the corporate guy, right? And I didn't have a strong connection to the people, the community. And I knew I was going to lose the election, Gerald, the day of the election, when a gentleman I ran against, you probably know the name, Nassif Majid. Majid had all these community folks at the polls, I mean, handing out his literature. And I had my wife, my fraternity brothers, my friends, right? And I was standing next to Mr. Majid, and he was rapping to people coming up to the polls, right? One, two, you know what to do. And right? And he knew them by name. He knew Ms. Johnson. He knew Mr. Franklin. He knew Tom. He knew Mr. Everett. I didn't know these people by name. And so I lost that election. Over the next 2 years, I literally went to every neighborhood meeting, every park function, every community cookout, every gathering to get to know the people in the community. And I ran again. I ran against Mr. Majid again, and this time I won. And so I was a member of the city council.
So let me ask you a question. You said you got lucky. What part in that was luck? Is it luck that you got the executive director job, or is it luck that you got the city council? Because it sounds to me you did a whole lot of hard work.
All of it is based in hard work, right? You think of preparation plus opportunity equals success, right? So you got to be prepared to take advantage of the opportunity. But sometimes just being in the right place at the right time. Donnie Simmons, you know Donnie, right? Donnie Simmons married a young lady who's a member of the Smith family that owns the two-way shop. Donnie is a graduate of Howard University. I went to that law school as well. And it was a fraternity brother of mine told me about the job at the purchasing council and encouraged me to apply, knew the then executive director who hired me. Now, if I didn't have the resume, he wouldn't have hired me, but, so here I am, 22, 23 as the assistant director. I probably was qualified to do that. But 6 months later, you're the executive director.
Right.
And so just a little lucky being at the right place at the right time. But people saw at that time that this guy has potential, that this guy can be trained. This guy is willing to have some furniture polish applied to him and some Windex. He's willing to do the hard work. And that's what the board says. Say, we know you don't know a whole lot about minority businesses and business and running a nonprofit organization, but what we see in you is somebody that's willing to learn and willing to put the hours in to get the job done. And that's what they did. And they surrounded me with people that to make sure that I would be successful. They made sure that I had a mentor, which was Mr. Young. They made sure that I knew Sam Johnson. They knew I knew Harvey Gann. And so they made sure that I was surrounded by people who would be vested in my success.
So let me ask you another question then. I want to kind of drill a little more on this, because you're saying something that is very, very important. And as you know, this podcast has a audience of young people, young teenagers, young professionals who are trying to learn and glean something from my guests. If you were to put on a scale from 1 to 10, the necessity of having mentors, 10 being the highest, 1 being the lowest, where would that rest?
It has to be a 10, right?
Okay.
Because you got to have somebody who's been there, who's seen it before, that can make sure that you avoid the mistakes that they have made. Right. I tell my daughters all the time, I say, I'm not telling you anything wrong. I'm just telling you that I've already been there. I know how that's going to turn out for you. But if you have someone who believes in you, believes in your potential, believe that you're teachable, believe that you're not a know-it-all, that you're willing to take constructive criticism, because part of being in a mentor-mentee relationship is sometimes you get criticized, like, no, that's not the way to do it. This is how you do it, and here's the reason why. Mm-hmm. If you open yourself to that, I mean, it's a world of knowledge. You know, Harvey Gantt, before I even ran for public office, I worked on his campaigns. You know, just watching him, right? Mm-hmm. Watching how he moves. His campaign manager at that time was a gentleman by the name of Mel Watt.
Right? Oh, wow.
Right?
Wow. Yeah,
that was Harvey's campaign manager. Now, Mel Watt is now former Congressman Watt, mm-hmm. right? Harvey Gantt ran for mayor, won, ran twice against Jesse Helm, should have won. But those are the type of people I kind of associated with. Don Baker was another great friend of Mel and Harvey. He's deceased. But Don was like, you know, he was just like the good cop, bad cop.
Mm-hmm.
Don was the bad cop, because when Don came, you know that Mel or Harvey told him to get with Malcolm and do ABCD.
Right.
But it was tough love, and it was all done in terms of trying to get me better, get me prepared, and that's what they did. So I getting a mentor, and even sometimes, Gerald, you don't have to be picked, right? You just watch somebody.
Mm-hmm.
They don't even have to know that you're watching them. Someone that you respect, someone that you want to emulate. When I was at the executive director of the organization, the office was at the Black Doctors Building on McDowell Street. McCain's and Farmers was in that building, the Black Bank. There was a Black pharmacist on the first floor. Mel Watt's law firm, Watt, Stein, Ferguson, with Julius Chambers and Mel Watt, they were on the top floor. Harvey Gantt's campaign office was in that building. Mel Watt announced his campaign for Congress in that building.
Wow.
A lot of the organizations in that building were headed up by Black executive directors or dentists. And so I was surrounded with all these folks who were doing great things. Frank Emery was in that building, right? And I was like 23, 24, 25, but I knew that I wanted to be like them. And being like them was being successful.
Mm. Wow. So you get onto the city council. Mr. McCall, you go to Mr. McCall and you get on the council. What was your experience on the council like? And how did that push you to becoming a senator in North Carolina? What was that dynamic like?
Oh, I loved it. I mean, again, all of a sudden now you get to do what you always dreamed about doing, right? Political science major, watching the Watergate hearing, watching other candidates run for public office, working on their campaigns. So now you're there, right? All preparation, but now you are at the desk making decisions that impact people's lives. And I was prepared to do it. I was ready to do it. I love serving. I represented District 4, a majority African-American districts, helping people from getting a bus stop in front of their housing development, crime and public safety, economic development, affordable housing, wide variety of issues that I was able to help shape and lead. And I did that for 4 years. And then Senator Downey, Charlie Downey, mm-hmm. the state of North Carolina, after redistricting, created a new Senate district. And they were looking for someone to run for it. And by that time, I was on city council for about 5 years. And knock on the door, Charlie Downey said, "This is what you're going to do."
I remember Mr. Downey. I can imagine how that conversation went.
Yeah, you know how he talks, Malcolm, this uh-huh. is what you need to do, right? And he told me about it and said, "I think you're ready for it. This is a quote-unquote promotion. You get to see it at a different level." And I ran against Fountain Odom, who was a white gentleman, had been in the state Senate for a number of years, former chairman of the county commission. No one gave me a chance in hell of winning. We ran that campaign, and we won with 65% of the vote, and wow. Was considered one of the largest upset in North Carolina at that time from that election cycle. And we went on to serve for 10 years in the state Senate.
Yeah, and when I met you, you were still in the state Senate because Dr. Yancey recruited me to Johnson C. Smith, and I believe you were still in the Senate at that time, if I'm not mistaken.
I was.
Yeah. Okay. So what's the difference between the Senate and the House? What was that like? And then how did you transition now back to you being at Johnson C. Smith when I was there, and then now you holding your current role once again serving the community? How can you walk us how that evolved?
Well, I served 10 years in the state Senate, and the difference between being on city council and the state Senate is that the state, no one cares at the local level who picks up the garbage. It's not a Republican way or a Democratic way to pick up the garbage. The garbage needs to be picked up. No one really cares in reference to economic development, whether it's a Democratic way or a Republican way. We just want to invest for good jobs in our community. So it was local government, although we had partisan labels, really wasn't partisan. Everything at the state Senate is partisan. These versus ours, everything that we do. For an example, you can't have closed door meetings at the city council. Every meeting is public meetings. At the state Senate, you know, we got caucuses. So the Democratic would caucus, the Republicans would caucus, we would come to vote, et cetera. So it was really, really partisan. That was the biggest difference. And it took a longer time for things to get done, right? And in city mm-hmm. council, you got 11 people around the dais. You make a decision relatively quickly. You can see the impact of the decision within a year or two. In the state Senate, things take a long time to happen. So mm-hmm. that's the unique difference. Then I decided to run for Congress. After serving in the state Senate, I ran against Alma Adams, you know, we should have won that campaign, but that's when the district stretched from Charlotte to Greensboro. Mel Watt had just got appointed by President Obama to serve in his administration, so the seat was open. And if anyone who knows math, they can figure this out relatively quickly. There were five candidates from Charlotte running. There was one young lady from Greensboro that ran, so it was six of us all together. I think you know how the math went, right? Mm-hmm. The five guys in Charlotte split up the votes. The young lady from Greensboro was able to get enough votes out of Charlotte, plus she didn't have to share any of the votes in Greensboro because mm-hmm. she was the only candidate from the area, and she won. And so that's when my career ended politically at that point. Mm-hmm. After I lost that run for Congress. But again, I ran into the new president. I was still a state senator, Dr. Carter. I hosted a fundraiser for Dr. Carter at my home, and he saw a plaque in my war room, my office downstairs, that talked about my desire as a council member to revitalize the Batesville Road Corridor. And he was really excited about this. Yes, I really want to do something about the corridor in front of Johnson C. Smith. He thought it needed to be cleaned up. He thought that the university needed a voice outside the gate, and asked me to come over to lead that initiative. Initially, we had a meeting in City Hall. It was me and Dr. Carter, Monroe Miller, who's then board chair, a couple other board members. We met with the city manager, and we talked about some of the lost opportunities that the university lost by not buying property and what the opportunities laid ahead. And he invited me to come and join this administration and help on the corridor.
Mm. I was able to drive by the corridor recently. It looks totally different from when I was there. I mean, to see the trams coming in and everything is actually pretty exciting to see what will happen in a couple of years.
Well, actually, Gerald, you don't have to wait a couple of years. The train will be on the track later this week. Yes.
Wow.
For the practice runs, and the trains will be running permanently in January. And so that's some of the work that me and you did together in terms of, you remember when you were there, we had the streetcar task force,
mm-hmm,
we did Mosaic Village, and then mm-hmm. we did the life underneath the bridge by I-77.
Right.
The city went ahead and did also the Straight Street expansion and mm-hmm. Rosso Ferry expansion. A lot of that work, Gerald, really resulted all of the work that we did at Smith, starting with Dr. Carter.
Wow. I just couldn't. When you're working on something and it's that far in the future, you have no idea how it's going to turn out. And I know that now with you being back on city council, you basically mm-hmm. have just picked up from where you left off, I would imagine.
You're absolutely right. I ran for city council again. The mayor recruited me. I needed some. I need you back. And I was out of public office, and I ran and won again, and I represent District 2, which is the Batesville Road area. And so I was able to come in and really pick up where I left off, right? Because a lot of those initiatives I was involved in, and as I told you before, you know this, the decisions that the university made, I agreed with. Others, I kind of questioned, but I was not a member of the board, nor was I the president. I worked for the president. And so mm-hmm. I think we got a lot of things right. There were some things I probably would have done differently mm-hmm. If it was my decision, but it wasn't. But I'm really proud of the work that we've done up and down that corridor. And I think, Gerald, when you come back, like I said, the trains are being installed this week. The practice wow. run starts next week. The permanent run starts in January. When you come back in April, you're going to see a totally different environment in front of the university that goes from the I-77 bridge all the way down to Batesville Road and LaSalle Street. I think you're going to be amazed.
I know I will be, because I remember before. And before we had to remove the bridge at Smith and all of that. So I remember mm-hmm. that distinctively. We have about 16 minutes left. And the guests that I have on this podcast, as I mentioned before, we try to hear your stories, and your stories, and yours, like all others, is inspirational. But we are currently in a moment in time where we are in a pandemic, and young people are graduating from college and even high school and having to make some tough choices about what's next. And you can see the level of anxiety and depression is kicking in. And if you had your druthers and could speak to young people, teenagers, yes, but young adults, young professionals, that 23 or 24-year-old hearing your story of how you got your start, what words of inspiration and encouragement would you share with them inside of what you are seeing based on your experiences over your career and what you're currently doing today?
I would tell them to be strong. and be strong. We're not here to play dream or drift. We have hard work to do and heavy loads to lift. Shun not the struggle, for it's God's gift. Be strong. I think we have to be strong, Gerald. I think we got to be focused. I think we got to be determined. I think we got to put it all on the line, like our lives depends on it, because it does. One thing that we hadn't talked about yet, and we talked about Charleston and Emmanuel, is that my sister Cynthia was a victim at the 2015 Emmanuel AME church shooting.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
She was one of the nine that lost her life. She didn't lose her life because she was doing anything inappropriate. She lost her life because she was there, and she happens to be Black.
Yes.
And so during this year, with the George Floyd and the police shootings and the protesting and the pushing back, our kids, our community needs to be strong and be forward thinking as we on the verge of election next Tuesday to demonstrate and use their voice with their vote. And it's okay to have fun. It's okay to the party. It's okay to hang out. All those things have its place. I did it. You did it, Joe. But even you, though, I know that I watch you, like I said earlier, there's a sense of seriousness about you, right? Mm-hmm. There's a sense of getting the job done. That's what we got to do as a community. We just got to get the job done, be strong, be focused, and be steady. Knowing that the more things change, the more they stay the same. And that we got to make sure that we as a community, we as a people of color, are forward thinking. And because things can always go backwards.
Amen. So well said. So well said. Now, as you sit here today and you and I are having this conversation, and you just mentioned that we have to do the work, what's next for Malcolm Graham?
Well, you know, I will be a grandfather in 2 weeks. And
congratulations. So, wow. Okay.
The first time, and so I'm excited about that. I'm excited that I'm in a place in my career where I can do what I want. So I'm not working for money, right? I'm working, but, you know, money is not a deciding factor anymore. Both of my kids are grown. They have master's degrees. They got jobs and benefits. And so now I can kind of pick and choose what I do. And what I'm doing now, I'm the executive director for an organization called Beds for Kids. And what we do is help furnish furniture to families in need. We're basically a furniture bank. Believe it or not, Gerald, there are people in our community sleeping on the floor, don't have a kitchen table, don't have a sofa, things that we take for granted. Mm-hmm. And so our organization provides those furnishings to families that need it. And so I enjoy that work. It's food for my soul to help people help themselves. I'm still serving as a member of the Charlotte City Council, and I enjoy the work there. I'm still active at Smith. I'm a member of their board of visitors, and so I want to continue to elevate and try to create a world-class institution there at the university. And, you know, maybe one day I'll give this congressional thing a try again. All right. It's like baseball. City council is double A, state senate is triple A. Congress is major league. And so I've been at both levels. I would love to see what playing in the majors feels and looks like. So, but I just enjoy life, Gerald. I enjoy watching my kids grow up. I'm watching the same values that my mom instilled in me, that me and Kim were able to instill in our girls, and watching them thrive and grow. One is in Atlanta with you. She's the assistant women's basketball coach at Clark Atlanta University. And my other daughter is in Atlanta as well. So they're both in your neck of the woods. And so I just enjoy, watching them grow and prosper and learn. And now my oldest, who is married, is adding to our family probably within the next day or so. I mean, she's due November 2nd.
Oh, wow. But, I'm not surprised by hearing you say these things, because some way, somehow, I knew your life was always going to be one totally about service. Now, I have seen recently a posting where you started this tennis tournament. So I take it you started it, or you're a part of it. So you're still playing tennis then?
Oh, yeah. We, the Cynthia Graham Hurd Foundation, which is, again, the foundation we started after my sister was killed at the Emmanuel AME Church shooting in Charleston, we created a foundation, and this foundation is based on reading and literacy. Cynthia was a librarian in the Charleston County Library System for well over 30 years. Upon her death, they named a library after her in Charleston, so it's the Cynthia Graham Hurd St. Andrews Regional Library. Right. The College of Charleston highest academic honor scholarship is awarded after Cynthia. It's called the Cynthia Graham Hurd Memorial Scholarship. Not only did Cynthia work 31 years at the public library, she worked 16 years at night at the College of Charleston Library as their night manager. She loved everything about reading and literacy, et cetera. She served as the chairman of the Charleston Housing Authority. So she was really active in the community. And so we established a foundation, and one of the events that we do is the Charlotte Amateur Tennis Championship, and all the proceeds go to benefit the work of the foundation, which is based in reading, literacy, and civic engagement. We did it this year for the second time, and we're going to do it again next year. Atrium Health is our primary sponsor, and so it's just a great way to raise the money by doing something I enjoy, which is tennis. Cynthia was not a tennis player, but growing up in Charleston, she was responsible for making sure she drove before I did. She would take me to tennis tournaments. She would take me to tennis practice. She would be around me in that space. And so we thought this would be a great way to have a little fun, raise a little money, and continue to honor and uplift Cynthia and her memory.
That is so awesome. So awesome. Now, I have a silly question to ask you. How good do you have to be considered an amateur to play?
Well, we have all categories, right? So tennis has a ranking system based on level of play. Uh-huh. And so it goes from 2.0, which is basically novice, to 3, 4, 5, and then the open division. The open division is the best of the best, the amateurs, right?
Oh, mm-hmm.
And so this year, a gentleman who was the number one player at UNC Charlotte won the open division, and a gentleman who just started playing tennis probably about 5 months ago won the 2.0 division. So there's every level of play, there's a competitive division for you. And even this year we had a division called just for the fun of it, right? So I don't want to be in the tournament, but I just want to be on the courts hitting some tennis balls, and you just pay your entry fee and you go out there and you play, and no one's keeping score, but you're just out there having some fun.
Okay.
Enjoying the weather and supporting the foundation.
Okay, well, you might be surprised one day, look up, you see a registration that comes in, says Gerald Hector. I used to play tennis. That was my first sport until I got to high school and realized that soccer and cricket and those things, track and field,
mm-hmm.
Was a little bit more popular. But I'd love to come by and support you and support what you're doing in the memory of your sister and what transpired with that rather tragic event in the history of this nation. With the remaining time we have left, Malcolm, I just want to ask you open-endedly, what words of inspiration? Now, some of my guests will say I'm not an inspiring person, but I know I've watched you over the years. I've watched you try to make something happen that's not there. So in terms of closing words, words of inspiration that you'll leave with this audience, what might that possibly be, given all that you're seeing happening in our world and our nation today?
It will be the motto of the foundation, which is keep the faith, do the work. keep the faith, do the work. And that's what Cynthia would always say. And it's something that, you know, my mom would say, again, growing up in Charleston, going to church, keep the faith and do the work. And if you do those two things, good things will happen for you.
Just that simple, huh?
Just that simple.
Just that simple. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you've just spent the last hour or so with my good friend and colleague, Mr. Malcolm Graham, someone that I have watched from a distance and seen his impact and what he's doing in the city of Charlotte, where I made my home for almost a decade. And I hope that, I trust and I know that some of the words shared here today and his story is also an inspiration to you and to all that we're seeing happening around us today. And as he said, keep the faith and do the work. Let's continue to do that. Well, that wraps up this week's episode of It's Easy, Son, your life lessons on your journey to your purpose. As always, be safe, vote, and we'll see you next week. Peace and blessings.